Okay, the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy will come to order. And Representative Myra moves the minutes of March 12th. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. That carries. Okay, the first, is this on?
Yes.
Okay. The first bill on the agenda is 1880. Oh, I'm sorry. Forgot about the department. It's Darcy Mills back there. When I requested that, and you're ready, I should have remembered. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Representatives, my name is Melvin Carter. I'm the director of the Minnesota Office of Early Learning at the Minnesota Department of Education.
Could you move this mic a little closer?
Yes. Is that better? Good afternoon. My name is Melvin Carter. I'm the director of the Office of Early Learning at the Minnesota Department of Education, which, as you know, is an office that spans as well the departments of Health and Human Services to bring those three agencies together to do better for young children and their families than we're able to do separately. I'm joined here by Lisa Barnage, who is our project manager, who has been working to make sure the scholarships and all of our Race to the Top work goes incredibly well. And doing a great job of it, I might add. We appreciate the invitation to come and share with you kind of an update on how we've been implementing scholarships and where we're going from here. We spent a good amount of this afternoon making sure we had a nifty PowerPoint presentation for you, forgetting that we were in this room.
Do you have a good PowerPoint presentation?
It's beautiful. Yeah, and I'll describe it in great detail as we go.
You're in trouble if you do, because we can actually 200 opened up.
Oh, really?
So now we've got you. I think, is it really important to have the PowerPoint?
Yeah, we can go through it. It's okay. We can go through it here. And okay. We can email it. Yeah, we can email it to you behind the conversation today. So no worries at all.
The committee's supposed to notify one place immediately when it opens up, which was this morning. We just found out about 5 minutes ago that 200's open.
Understood. No worries. That'll be just fine. We can walk through the conversation.
Thank you.
So we'll walk through the conversation, and I'll flip the pages. As you know, the purpose of the early learning scholarships was to increase access to high-quality early childhood programs for 3 to 5-year-olds and to support the kindergarten readiness of children with the highest needs in our state. I'll jump to the punchlines and go back and tell you kind of the detail stuff. Essentially, you funded about 4,057 scholarships, the resources that were provided in last year's legislative session. Of those, over 90% of them have actually already been awarded and are in use across the state. 3,000 as of the end of February 28th, 2014, 3,758 of those scholarships have been awarded. As I give that number, I'll make a note that we have formal reporting periods in place, and the next one will be, I believe, March 31st. And so at that point in time, we'll be able to give a more formal number. We'll call that the number I just gave you an informal number based on kind of a survey that we did across the state in preparation for coming to you today. And so the scholarships have been well received across the state. Our regional administrators are administering them very well. We have, I think, two regions where we are in the process of where we probably have more scholarships still available. But other than that, in 10 of the 13 regions across the state, we actually have waiting lists for the scholarships. The goals of the scholarship program was to provide children with high needs with access to a high-quality early learning setting of their choice, to build upon lessons learned from previous scholarship pilots which have happened throughout the state, and also to establish infrastructure for growing and sustaining a comprehensive early learning system in Minnesota. We're doing all of those things. We are distributed the scholarships regionally. They reach all of the governor's 13 economic development regions, and our goal was a balanced and fair distribution based on kindergarten free and reduced lunch for Metro and Greater Minnesota. It ended up being about 50-50, I think 51% of those scholarships based on that formula, which is tracking the compensatory revenue formula which we use for the state. About 51% of those scholarships ended up in the Metro area, and 49% of those ended up in Greater Minnesota. We have, important to note, approximately 4,057 scholarships funded, which it's important to note funds scholarships for approximately 9% of the low-income children in Minnesota who could use resources like that. As we developed the formula to figure out kind of how to distribute them around the state, we use a few determining factors, the first one being percentage poverty based on kindergarten free and reduced price lunch. We used the children in kindergartens across in districts across the state, the percentage of the children who were on free and reduced price lunch, again similar to the compensatory revenue formula. We also looked at the existence of a priority school in the community, the existence of current state funded early learning scholarships, which was 10
just community. Question, what did you say? Priority school?
Yes, a priority school in the community, which is the 5% lowest performing schools based on multiple measures. They're also frequently the schools that have the highest number of children in poverty in the state. And so these are the places where we decided to prioritize making sure the scholarships got the place with the highest percentage poverty, the existence of a priority school, the existence of current state-funded early learning scholarships to maintain some continuity from those children who are already on scholarships, not wanting the new resource investment to be kicking children off of scholarships was critical, and also making sure that the cities of the first class in our state, which include Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and Duluth, were all included as well. At this point, Pathway 1 scholarships are available to families in, I believe, 44 counties throughout the state. Pathway 1 and 2, I should clarify that first. I'll say that first. There are two ways that families and children can access scholarships. Pathway 1, our scholarships are awarded directly to eligible children through a regional scholarship administrator based on the provider's parent awareness quality rating. So providers who are rated 3 and 4 stars are eligible to receive up to $5,000 per year. Providers who are 1 and 2 stars in the parent aware rating program are eligible to receive up to $4,000 per year, and providers with the signed participation agreement also are eligible to receive up to $3,000 per child per year. So that's Pathway 1. Pathway 2 are where early learning scholarships are awarded to children through a 4-star parent-aware rated early childhood site. That has been really critical to our ability to build capacity in our state and making sure that providers all throughout our state where, you know, we hear from providers in greater Minnesota who say, you know, one of their challenges is really capacity and making sure that they build the capacity, and building that kind of capacity we found around the state requires having providers to be able to count on and know that resources are coming in a way that will allow them to make improvements to their programs and hire staff and those types of investments and make those types of investments. Right now, as I said earlier, Pathway 1 scholarships are available in 44 counties across our state. I've got a map pass these maps that show where Pathway 1 and Pathway 2 scholarships are available, and then I've got a combined map, again, because I thought we were going to be projecting this in full color. They're smaller than I would have had them otherwise, but maybe is it okay to pass them around the table?
The page will.
Thank you. That's fine, either way. Okay, so I think he'll make copies, but again, it'll be in the presentation that we'll email to you all as we probably tomorrow morning after this. So between the Pathway 1 and Pathway 2 scholarships, we've got a pretty good section of our state covered with scholarships being used, again, in all 13 of the governor's economic development regions. Right now, there are a set of challenges. I'll say we had the wonderful challenge of having to sort of ramp up scholarships and administer them in the summertime with the goal of getting resources in the hands of families as closely as possible to the beginning of the school year. Our team worked, literally burned the midnight oil to work hard to make that happen. We'd acknowledge that there are some lessons learned from trying to move so fast, and there are a set of challenges that we're troubleshooting right now. One of them is the application process. We've heard from across the state providers and also parents saying that the application process is onerous and could be made simpler. We're working with some of our providers around the state and receiving a lot of really good ideas from different organizations, certainly including Think Small and our regional administrators across the state, to make that scholarship process more simply and to make it more family friendly. So that's one of the main things that we are troubleshooting at this point. And again, just to reiterate, we've got 3,758 scholarships currently awarded and in place as of February 28th. Of the 4,057 scholarships that were funded in the last legislative session. That's the general overview that we came to present. I don't know if there's any questions, we can certainly stand for any questions.
First question. I asked our research to just do a quick thing on, because I remember talking to the commissioner about the way she put out scholarships. I remember she said, I think it was that it went by, apparently it's free and reduced lunch, which is basically the income level of the parents. And so and she said she did it by school district, which, of course, doesn't make much sense to me, because when you look at Minneapolis, you have extremely poor concentrated poverty, and then you have a lot of extremely wealth, very big wealth in the Southwest quadrant. And the people from the Southwest quadrant don't come over at night and give $100 bills out to the people in the poor areas. So that made absolutely no sense to me to do any kind of a pouring out money on that basis. And is our research said that there was 178 scholarships to St. Paul and 62 to Minneapolis about 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago. How does that justify? I don't know if that's the reason, but when I talk to the people, the actual workers, what's the name? Is it connectors?
The navigators?
The navigator, not the navigators, the others. Starts with a C. Anyhow, the other group of workers there. They said it was very hard to get any families the scholarships under the way it was set up by the commissioner. One of the issues Ryan has in his bill, mine too, the 5,000 cap. When I first met with about 30 of them, or 23, something like that, and said, are there any problems? They all just yelled out the 5,000 cap is unworkable. So that's an issue I have concerns about. Why is there this discrepancy in that? And it's apparently based on that formula that I've been told doesn't make any sense by a lot of people that work in this area. So are you on your own going back and going to rethink how you send out those scholarships, or are you going to continue?
Well,
it is, and I guess there's about four questions in that. Sorry, but
that's okay. And we've had some of this conversation, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The formula that was used does track the compensatory revenue formula, and we felt comfortable using that formula mostly because it's a pretty long established and generally well accepted kind of measure for concentration of poverty. You're absolutely right; it does track free and reduced lunches. Students on free and reduced lunch, as a percentage of the general student population. We limited it to kindergarten just because that's obviously the closest age that we have the data for there, and also because as students age, the families tend to have more income as the kind of time goes on. So we figured that was probably the closest that we could use, where we actually have the data, and you know, because we have the data on the district level, and so that's where that formula was. That's why that formula was used. We haven't anticipated changing the formula at this point in time, but your concerns are definitely noted. So I'd continue the conversation.
It's not just Minneapolis is maybe in a one of the greatest examples because there's so much difference in the concentrations of poverty and other extremely negative factors on kids here, and then there's great wealth someplace else, and these kids aren't benefiting from that wealth. But there's, I was just informed, for instance, I think it was Lynn Carlson was telling me yesterday that there's not quite so extreme, but there's suburban districts that are similar, where there's concentration of poverty here and the kids have a lot of issues,
mm-hmm.
and then there's great wealth. And so it doesn't make much sense because these kids don't benefit from this wealth. But I'll go to, and I'll come back to it later, and also ask about those numbers, but I'm going to go to Representative Winkler first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carter, just a couple quick questions about the pathway two. So your testimony about the compensatory revenue formula being used to distribute the funds, I assume that was what you were talking about for pathway two, and you can just sort of...
That's for all of the funds.
That's for pathway one and for pathway two, to determine where they're available overall in the state?
Yes.
And when it comes to the pathway two, where did the what sites ended up getting the funds? I know it was generally, I think, pretty evenly between Greater Minnesota and the metro area. Mm-hmm. I understand that. Where did the, in the Pathway 2, where did the funds end up going?
For those, for Pathway 2 scholarships, I should have clarified this earlier. I appreciate the question. Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, those Pathway 2 scholarships are available only through 4-star rated providers. And so there's just a set of 4-star rated providers through the state that includes many school districts, Head Start, and also kind of major and 4-star rated providers of kind of all sizes throughout the state. Child care provider.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carter, so, but just as a practical matter, can you kind of break it down? Like, so much went to schools, so much went to Head Start, so much went to nonprofits, so much went to for-profit. Can you give any kind of, doesn't have to be exact, but just a sense of it?
I don't.
Director Carter, is that your title? Director, or what? You're not commissioner?
That won't be the worst thing I've been called this week. That's that works just fine. Thank you, sir.
Is that?
Yes, that's the title.
Director Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I don't have that information at on my fingertips right now, but we can definitely follow up with that information.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Mr. Carter, what I'm trying to kind of, you know, in Greater Minnesota especially, I'm going to guess a lot of the 4-star programs are going to tend to be in schools, but I'm not sure of that. In the metro area, there's probably more diverse capacity of the 4-star rated programs would be my guess. Question I have, I know there's folks who are interested in school readiness funds. I know that's been a discussion in the K-12 Finance Committee and, you know, kind of distributing money between school readiness and the scholarships. And I guess the reason I'm asking is I'm curious to know, to the extent the money is going out to school districts for these scholarships, does it sort of end up kind of functioning in the school district like more school readiness dollars, or is it somehow different? But or you know, are the schools essentially using it as though it was a school readiness kind of funding stream?
Director Carter, or somebody. I'm sorry, what was your name again?
Mr. Chair, my name is Lisa Barnage. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Education.
Barnage?
Barnage.
B-A-R-N-I-D-G-E. Thank you. Go ahead.
Representative Winkler, I don't know if I can make some generalizations to that question. I do know that some people have looked at the applications or a subset of applications of the Pathway to applications and have been able to identify where some of the funding was used. I could talk with them and see if they have any thoughts as well about how that is being used. The school districts programs and Head Start programs and child care programs, I think if I recall correctly, what the analysis showed was that there was a lot of expansion of programs, as well as expansion including opening new classrooms, serving more children, as well as extension of period of time that children are served in the programs. So if they had more school readiness funds, it's possible. One thing I do know is that school readiness funds are more flexible than the scholarship funds, so they could possibly use school readiness funds for other things as well.
Mr. Chair, I looked like there was a member of the audience who had an answer to the question, but I'm not sure if that's true or not.
Actually to the previous question.
Ms. Barnage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I have been handed a rough estimate of where funds have gone for Pathway 2s.
Okay.
The rough estimate shows approximately 70% went to school districts, 14% went to child care centers. Those child care centers may be for-profit or non-profit, so I don't have that breakdown, and 22% went to Head Start.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler, I'm going to interrupt because Representative Brainerd had questions. She has to leave.
Yep, I'm done.
Actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler started toward my question, but we did hear testimony this morning in education finance from people advocating for additional funding for school readiness, and they were asked about how the scholarship program was working for them, and they expressed concerns regarding the timing of the payments. And this was an issue we actually tried to address last session, and you know, by trying to create the opportunity that those payments could be accounted for earlier in the school year. Do you remember this discussion? Maybe not. We did have this discussion both in committee and in conference committee with the commissioners. So I'm just wondering what your response is to that and what the status of working that out is in a way that schools have more predictability in terms of planning for their enrollment.
Ms. Barnage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brainerd, quick kind of forethought about what we've also heard at the department from school districts is school readiness funds school districts draw down from the Department of Education directly, and for scholarships, they are on reimbursement only basis. So school districts must first expend the funds and then request reimbursement. So they have to go through an invoice process. This is how it is for all program types. So I do know it's not something that school districts do as often because their funding stream comes directly through MDE, through systems to their bank accounts pretty much. So it does. There is a delay from that sense. As for one thing that we are trying to do, which we were unfortunately unable to do this past year due to the quick timelines of trying to get funding out the door from May to September, but we do hope that we have already started for this year and hope for any future years that we actually would be able to inform programs of all types of any pathway to allocations prior to July, even prior to July 1st, hopefully starting to talk to them and having running a process in the winter, because we do know that school districts and Head Starts and possibly even child care centers, they do their budgeting process the year prior to September or in the winter, and so we want to try to help them in that as much as possible. Now that we have a more stable program, hopefully, we can try to meet their needs as well by providing the process earlier.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
And Representative Winkler, did you want
to? I'm good.
Okay, Representative Lane.
My questions had to do with the pathways, too. I didn't know this before, so I had some questions about that. And I guess I need more clarification as to when you do the pathway two, and it goes, for instance, mostly to a school district. Is that serving a child that never would have been served before? Do they pick somebody out and put them in that school? And is that money serving that child? I mean, as money goes into that program, sure, it would benefit everybody. That's one of the advantages of this. But, several years back, MELF really worked and showed how you do an intensified program for a child a scholarship, a true scholarship in that sense, and bring the whole family in. It's a whole family project, and it really intensified and changed the trajectory for that child's life. We call it scholarships now to be able to distribute to those who have need. My concern is that we'll get to a point where we're just basically having another program that loses that intensification and won't have the same outcomes that, for instance, MELF proved when you truly intensify for the whole family. Talk to me about Pathway 2 and how that is working for one particular child who would not have been served before.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, thank you. So for the Pathway 2 scholarships, they actually, we've tried to mirror them as much as possible to Pathway 1s and the uses of the scholarship. The language in the statute says that a 4-star rated program can apply to the commissioner in order to request a block of scholarships for expansion or enhancements. And when we did the Pathway 2 application this summer, what we wanted to ensure is that if they did use them for enhancements, that we use them for reasons that we have, research has shown, are going to improve outcomes for children. The Department of Education did have, along with our partners at the Department of Human Services, several years back had a governor's summit that highlighted what we now call our 10 essential elements for high-quality programs. And we, in our application process, asked that any enhancements align with those 10 essential elements. I can't name them off the top of my head, but I do know they are things like ensuring that the program is offered with enough intensity and time to allow for that child to truly benefit from the program, low ratios to allow that one-on-one teacher or more teacher contact. So we do believe that all children will benefit and are benefiting from early learning scholarships, whether it be for Pathway 1 or Pathway 2. Additionally, what we have seen is that a majority of the scholarships were used for expansion. So we do feel that they'll hopefully have that same impact. Of course, there will be an evaluation in the future to measure that more, as well as required under the statute.
Thank you. I'll just make the comment that as we consider increasing the amount of money in scholarships, I need to have some comfort around where that money is going.
Ditto. That's what a number of us are extremely concerned about. Were you finished, Representative?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, that is my question to the testifiers there. I would like to see those detailed reports and exactly who got the money with which district, centers, and Head Start programs. So if I could have that by the end of next week, that would be great. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Did you have a question, follow-up, or consent? Okay. Are there any other questions from anybody? Back to my question, why the difference in Minneapolis-St. Paul? 178 to 62.
Mr. Chair, I will have to say, perhaps we could have a further conversation regarding the numbers where they are coming from. I'm not sure if they're Pathway 1s or Pathway 2s or just what you know so far of what has been awarded. What the formula did look at was the free and reduced lunch counts. And then what I can speak to, because I have it right here in front of me, is what the formula provided to the school district attendance areas for St. Paul and for Minneapolis. And that formula, which is just for Pathway 2s, 315 scholarships were available for St. Paul, and 248 were available at the $5,000 amount for Minneapolis. The data I also have in front of me shows that the two school districts have approximately similar kindergarten enrollment levels, but that St. Paul does have a 68% free and reduced lunch, while Minneapolis has a 61% free and reduced lunch. So that would be the primary reason for the additional 60 scholarships in St. Paul over Minneapolis.
And if we're looking at, as some of us want to put the resources we do have into the most needy, that would not be an effective formula, putting things into the most needy. So, you know, there's a difference in the legislature whether we should spread it out. It's kind of like if it snows all over the continent at one point, doesn't even if you don't notice anywhere, but if you put all of it in the capital here, you'll really notice it. So there's a difference going on in us too. In there. I guess, is there anybody, no more questions? Okay, I guess, thank you, Director Carter and Ms. Barnage, for your presentation, and you can send us the rest. There may be questions on other bills. I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm attending a dinner right now that I'm.
Oh, you are.
I'm on the program. I believe Ms. Barnage is going to be staying on.
Okay. Thank you very much. Then we will go to Representative. Representative Winkler moves House File 2754 be referred to Committee on Education and Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. I would actually, you know, we've had a pretty good discussion already about some of the administration of these scholarships so far, and I think it's easy to be concerned about some of the ways that this was rolled out in the first year. And obviously I've had some differences of opinion in the last year with the Department of Education about some of these issues, but the model works, and we have some folks here who can talk about the ways in which the scholarship model tied to quality is working and how removing the cap and increasing the amount of funds will help. And I would just particularly point out, you know, we are talking about 9% of kids, of eligible kids, being funded through this program, so there is no way to do that and be fair, because you're leaving out 91% of eligible kids from even getting into the program. So you can spread it out geographically, you can take a little bit of scholarship and spread it out among a lot of kids, you can take a few kids and give them everything they need, but then you're still going to be making choices about who gets it and who doesn't, and we all know that all those kids could use it and deserve it. So there are going to be challenges until we find ways to put a much more significant amount of money into early childhood scholarships. But that doesn't mean the model's not working. There are a lot of success stories, and we're going to hear some support for this bill and a little bit of how this has worked well. So I think, Eric, you're first.
Eric, do you just state your name?
Sure. Eric Haughey from AFSCME Council 5. Thanks to Representative Winkler for carrying this bill. You know, we represent about 43,000 employees across the state, and our support of these early childhood scholarships lies in our desire to have a better prepared workforce, which we know is one of the many benefits of investing in high-quality early childhood programs. The family child care providers that we work with have seen the impact that these dollars have made in the lives of the families that they serve. Mary couldn't be here tonight, but she's a 4-star, parent-aware-rated, accredited family child care provider here in St. Paul. Tommy, who's 4 years old, comes to her house for child care. Her parents could only afford care for 3 days a week because there was a long waiting list for basic sliding fee child care. The other days, she went to Grandma's for her care. Mary shared the information about the scholarship with Tommy's parents. They applied, and now he's able to attend her program 5 days a week until he starts kindergarten. But the benefits have extended even further. Now that they don't have Tommy's child care expenses, they can afford after school care for 5 days a week for their older child. This is just one story out of many I've heard across the state. The early childhood scholarships allow parents to choose the setting that best meets their need, whether it's a school-based program, Head Start, a child care center, or, as often the case across the state, family child care. And one of the beauties of the scholarships is that the money follows the child, which allows for continuity of care in a high-quality setting. As Representative Winkler alluded to, are the scholarships working perfectly? No. But there are efforts underway to make them better? Absolutely. And AFSCME is committed to ensuring that the providers' voices across the state are heard as these efforts continue, because our members have seen directly the positive impact that these resources are having. So thanks for the opportunity.
Ms. Yates or Ms. Okay. The three of you I see all the time the last couple of years. Barb, you next.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Barb Yates. I work at Think Small. We're one of the scholarship administrators, and we're working in the metro area and Region 3, which is in northeastern Minnesota, distributing the scholarships. What I wanted to tell you about briefly is we started taking applications about mid-October for Pathway 1 scholarships. In the first 4 weeks, we took 2,100 applications. We had 1,046 scholarships to make in the 7-county metro area. So we very, very quickly had more than enough families. In fact, we have lots of families on the waiting list. We hear a lot more concerns from those on the waiting list about that they didn't get a scholarship than the length of the form, frankly. They are very eager to be involved in that. Right now, we have 1,716 children on a waiting list for this program, and that's after we quickly ramped back from taking applications when we exceeded the numbers we had so quickly.
Mr. Chair, I advise that with a session like this, brief testimony is more beneficial than
lengthy
testimony.
Ms. Yost.
Good afternoon. I'm Nancy Jost. I work for West Central Initiative out of Fergus Falls. And I've had the opportunity to talk to families about scholarships. I talked to a couple families who received scholarships, and they were just thrilled. They said it was not only good for their children, but it was really life-changing for their whole family. I talked to a mom whose husband is disabled, and she was the only working adult in the family and had three children. And she was going to have to quit work because she couldn't afford childcare and transportation and all the other things she needed to take care of. And she found out about the scholarships. She applied for them, received them for her three children. And she was in a family childcare provider who's working towards her star rating. And now the parent can take the children to a high-quality childcare home. She can work, and she can pay all of her bills. So it's not just about the kids, but it's really about families. The last 2 days, I've had the opportunity to meet with probably 40 people who work in Head Start, in schools, and in childcare. And when I was leaving yesterday, I asked them if they could talk to the legislators what they would say. What message could I provide to you from them? And some of them said, well, scholarships, they're not even available in our county, so it really is a non-issue for us. And I said, does that mean you don't like scholarships? You'd like to get rid of them? Absolutely not. We just want to have a chance to have scholarships in our counties. And the ones that got scholarships said, oh my gosh, these are just so wonderful. We just need more. We need more. And in our region, there are 9 counties and the White Earth Nation. And some of them are eligible for scholarships and parent aware, and some are not yet. So it also causes a little bit of tension between those that get the chance to have them and those that don't. But everybody wants the chance. I was also asked by someone who got to tell a parent that she received a scholarship. And she said, have you ever had the opportunity to be there when that happens? And I said, no. She said, oh, if you could only see the faces of parents when they find out that they receive a scholarship. She said, it's just heartwarming. Again, it's not just about the kids. Of course, those are the people that we have in mind mostly, but it's about changing families. So you've really done a wonderful thing by providing scholarships, and you do a wonderful thing by providing more scholarships. Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the provisions of the bill, just briefly, Section 1, Subdivision, Section 1, Subdivision 3, Part B, is essentially a removal of the $5,000 hard cap, and it asks the Commissioner of Education to establish a target for the average scholarship per child based on the actual rates that are charged in the marketplace for child for quality child care. So they basically have to develop a model for what it costs and try to target an average scholarship amount statewide. But it provides maximum flexibility for the Department of Education, but more especially for the people who are administering the program, for the centers that are taking care of kids, for the families themselves, because there are so many different funding sources involved in providing high-quality child care that by removing the cap and allowing for maximum flexibility, they are best able to figure out ways of serving the kids based on their individual circumstances. Section 2 is a fiscal issue, Mr. Chair, that I'm sure a lot of fiscal folks in the legislature might be concerned about the way it's put together, but this is recognizing that we're serving 9% of eligible kids. And what this calls for is for the legislature to double the appropriation for the scholarships in every budget biennium until all kids who are eligible are able to access these funds. And obviously, we can't necessarily bind future legislatures. They'd be free to change this. But the idea is that we have a serious ramp-up that we need to do if we want to have more stories about families having their lives changed and having children have stable, high-quality environments for their early education and their child care experience. If we want to have that be something that is available to all kids and not get into this issue of should we do a good job for a few kids or a little bit of a job for a lot of kids, if we want to get to the point of really talking about serving all kids well, we have a serious funding increase ahead of us. And then finally, Section 3 is a step in the right direction. We have a significant budget surplus. We started this program last year. There is a lot of capacity left in rated programs to increase the funding. And so we increased that from $23 million to $43 million in this budget biennium. And it so happens that the $20 million increase is about what it would cost to fully fund the scholarships for the kids who have them now. So if you want to remove the cap, give those kids the full quality experience year-round that they need, the $20 million helps do that for the existing scholarships that are out there. That is the bill, Mr. Chair, and I share committee members' concerns about some of the administration issues that have arisen in the first year. I think given that this is the first year of a new program, that some of that is to be expected. But I think starting here is a good place to move this in the right direction.
And thank you. And we're not going to, this committee doesn't have any budget. We're not going to talk about the budget issues. And I probably, as I told you, if I was on the Finance Committee, I probably wouldn't vote for a requirement that a future legislature double it. But in this committee, that isn't an issue. So, Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, your testifier, Mr. Hauge, talked about family child care providers, and I was wondering what the percentage of scholarships went to those providers. Earlier it was discussed that Pathway 2, 70% to schools, 22 to Head Start, 14 to child care centers. How about, is it under Pathway 1 that family child care providers would be receiving scholarships?
I think Ms. Gates is the best answer to that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can get you the breakout, but I can tell you that in the metro area, and I think many other areas in the state, we looked at Pathway 1, Pathway 2, where dollars were going, and tried to balance that across program types, roughly a third, a third, a third for Head Start child care and for school-based programs. Obviously, in Pathway 1, parents are making choices, so we don't always know where that's going to end up. So that won't be, but in the pilots, it worked out that way without even putting structures around them in the metro area, at least. I can give you the breakout. I don't have it with me today, but I can give you the breakout between child care centers and family child care.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
That's it.
Yes.
No other questions? Then, sorry. There's one person signed up before I open it to everybody else. Cindy Cunningham. And after that, anybody else that wants to testify. She's the only one that we had signed up in advance. Okay, Ms. Cunningham. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
You have to state your name and then go ahead.
Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Cindy Cunningham. I have statements for all three bills that I would like to address, but if I could just give a quick introduction so you know who I am. First in general, my name is Cindy Cunningham. I've been a taxpayer in Minnesota for 30 years, a parent of three children, a licensed family child care provider in Ramsey County for 16 years, and I'm currently in the process of obtaining my star rating with Parent Aware. I have served families of all socioeconomic levels, including those utilizing the Child Care Assistance Program. I began my journey in early childhood family education during college 36 years ago. I appreciate this an evening meeting to be able to come, as my families have been inconvenienced twice already this week. I understand that this is a very challenging and complex issue, and the scholarship program is trying to address that. I will speak to the areas that I personally experience, and that is as a parent, as a taxpayer, and as a family child care provider. As a taxpayer and as a provider who may have families using this fund, I have been greatly concerned about the scholarships for the past year and a half. I believe strongly in early childhood education and do understand the impact of the socioeconomic status of families on education. I am greatly concerned that this is very center-directed and Head Start-directed and school-directed, and that families will not really have a full choice because family child care is not as fully utilized and considered in the process, and that therefore then will take away the choices that family has. Specifically on this bill, budget's not mine, but I will raise a couple questions from the perspective as a family child care provider and a business, not a center. The target rate, let me get to that point again, I'm sorry. This target rate of the funding and the scholarship amount, my great concern on that is that we have all lived and worked with the CCAP target rates and the funding rates with those at the 70%. It's not been ever realized. And we as child care providers under law have the right and responsibility to charge the difference between a CCAP rate family's payments to us and our business rates. I've looked through all of the bills through the time period, and I have yet to see anything that helps us understand what we are to do with those dollar amounts. And so $5,000 would not get very far with anyone in the metro area or otherwise, so the increase would assist that. However, the process of putting an unending cap on that is concerning to me because, again, there still is no business model built in for us of that rate. If I'm in the middle and the scholarship doesn't meet that, how do I recoup the additional fees that go with that? As a taxpayer, I'm greatly concerned with the increases in funding. Since you said it wasn't funding, finance, maybe I won't say too much except that I fear that the next legislation and budgeting, this is just going to be a big problem as taxpayers
the,
for us.
The finance issues are, you should show up at when it gets to the next committee at finance.
Good. I'll see if I can get there. Thank you. I really have a concern about the, Representative Lane, as a family child care provider, we are all greatly concerned that that is a huge missing piece in this. We don't experience the family part of it in it, and that is a piece not only as us as business providers and as child care providers and that, but the encompassing use of the whole change in the family system does not seem to be present in any of this. So.
Thank you.
That's my comment.
Is there anybody else that wanted to testify in this bill? Somebody has their hand up. Do you want to come up? State your name and go ahead.
I'm Andrea Barrano Robinson, and thank you, Chair and representatives. I'm here to testify on House File number 1880. I'm a parent of three children, 7, 4, and 1. My concern is that my husband works really hard for our family. And and I feel that because I'm unable to work because I'm physically disabled, it limits our chances, our ability to enhance our children's education. We understand that with previous legislation, I was able to get a home visitor. Oh, thank you. I was able to get a home visitor and when I was pregnant with my first son. And because of that, here, fast forward, I've gone through the system with my first son. He is now second grade, reads at a fifth grade level, does math at a fifth grade level, and that's because he had early childhood interventions, including preschool programs. So now we get to my four-year-old. Think Small. I knew of Many Minds, but I did not know that I could have registered in October when my son turned four, or before then because he was three. I was uninformed parent, unfortunately, and now I have registered him. I have gone through the process, and I'm here to say that process is not user-friendly. It is 9 pages long. Mm-hmm. It is repetitive. If you look at the sheet, it's repetitive. It asks for the same questions at least 3 times. In fact, I did mine wrong because I didn't understand how to do it. Luckily, Think Small was kind enough not to send it all back and reject it, but work with me on the piece that was missing. But if my other subsequent children don't get the opportunities that are allotted to them for early childhood process, I have a feeling that they will be catching up in kindergarten, and that is exactly what I and many of my other parents would like to avoid, is spending a lot of time catching up our students. I feel as a parent, this is a great opportunity. I live in New Hope, Minnesota, which is a representative, Lyndon Carson's, he's my representative, and I understand that we are one of the few suburbs that are getting some funding. But there is quite a few of us on the waiting list in my school district. So I would just like to have you guys support.
Could you spell your name before you?
Oh, I'm sorry. My whole name or just my last? Okay.
I thought it was Robinson.
It's Berran Robinson, but it's A-N-D-R-E-A, that's Andrea. And my last name is B as in boy, E as in elephant, J as in Jack, A as in apple, R as in rabbit, A as in apple, N as in Nancy, O as in octopus, - Robinson. I do this a lot, can you tell? And
that's why you have trouble filling it out. You use up the page.
Yeah. But the main reason why I'm up here is because a lot of my friends and family couldn't be, that need this scholarship as well. I happen to be a Latina American, and it's very important for us in our community, in the Latin community, to support our children.
Thank you. And one of the issues is in my bill later about the getting around that huge process.
Yes, I know. That's why I mentioned it.
And then your representative has a bill in that's quite a bit like mine also. I think I just signed on to it today, so
there'll be, so you can talk to him, your own representative, about his bill. But back, I guess there's no more testimony, so I would, I'm sorry, almost missed. Representative Kresha.
Thank you, Chair Mayor. Thank you, Chair Mullery. Just a quick question. I'm wondering if, Chair Mullery, if we could bring the testifier, Ms. Cunningham, and the Ask Me rep back up. I just have a quick question for them. I can wait, too, if you don't want to do that now.
I guess we can. When we're just about done with this bill, so did you want it on this bill? Or?
Yes, I just have a quick question on this bill.
I did.
Then we'll do it now. Then.
Is that okay?
Yeah, we need to get on to the next bill. So.
I understand. I'll make it quick.
That's fine. Mr. Hauge and Ms. Cunningham, you're both there now.
And did I get the names right, Mr. Hauge and Ms. Cunningham?
Okay.
So here's my question to you, Chair Mullery. As I look through the Minnesota Early Learning...
A question to me or...
That? Well,
okay.
Following protocol to the chair who's going to direct it. So, from the department's report in July of 2013, there's a section on there that says the scholarships may also be used to cover parent fees, rates, or other charges for families not covered by the Child Care Assistance Program or other programs. Here's my concern, and I'm a big supporter of this. Please understand I'm trying to reconcile this. Are we doing child care or are we doing early learning scholarships? And there's a sizable chunk of allocation here, and I have to reconcile that if I'm going to support this moving forward. And I'll be honest with the Ask Me rep there, and as you mentioned, the CCAP, I want to make sure daycare providers, child care providers, however you want to phrase that, are not simply tapping into this funds and misconstruing the high levels of teaching that we expect for early childhood.
Well, just one second, they can go. I don't think that's a either or, whether we're doing child care or early learning.
I just want to see where those lines blur. I want to understand, so we're not tapping into funds just because they're available.
Okay. Which of you, raise your hand if you want to answer it. I can.
So the
Mr.
Chair, Representative. So the difference, the question is the difference between child care and
CCAP. Chair Mullery? I understand the difference.
Representative Kresha, yeah. Go ahead.
I understand the difference. Do we understand the difference out there? I want to make absolute certainty that we know what we're doing for early childhood scholarships and the teaching around those versus child care. I realize we're trying to elevate child care, but there is a difference, and there's lots of standards and accreditation that goes with teaching kids versus child care.
And Representative Kresha, a lot of us would disagree and think that child care is supposed to be doing that, but
Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr. Hauge.
In the providers that I've talked to, they are rated providers, and so they've gone through the parent aware rating process. Some of them are even accredited on top of that or in addition to that. So they are high quality providers in the ones that I've talked to. Does that
quite
answer?
Representative Kresha, quite a few people think child care providers are early learning teachers and that the ones that aren't are babysitters.
And to that point, I agree with you there. But my point is we have to make sure we make that distinction. Because I to use your terms, we can't pass babysitters off as early learning providers. That's disingenuous to our teaching profession.
I totally agree with you. Ms. Cunningham, did you want to also...
Of course, answer? I'd like to comment.
Okay.
And I apologize, I don't mean to be blunt, but I want to understand this issue.
Ms. Cunningham.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I don't know the pronunciation of your name.
Kresha.
And I can't see it.
Whatever you'd like it to be.
Okay, I'm sorry. I always get stumbling in this situation. I think, for one, the scholarships are for parent-aware rated families, or family child care, excuse me, stumbling. So whether we're family child care providers or center or school-based, the scholarships are strictly towards parent-aware rated 1, 2, 3, 4. There's other bills that complicate that and make that differently, but I believe the scholarships will always be connected with the parent-aware. That being said, I also know there are bills being considered for CCAP to be connected to Parent Aware. I think the whole piece is to try to ensure, not correct or make it happen, that family child care, which is what I can speak to. Most of the Parent Aware I will speak to is documentation of what we're already doing. The majority of providers, myself included, it's more putting it on paper what we're actually already doing. Family child care interwines it throughout the day versus a three-year-old classroom in a center will look much different than when I'm running a nine-month-old to a five-year-old. It all happens during the day. All of the learning happens during the day. This looks a lot different when I do that. So as a potentially parent-aware provider, it's paperwork, it's documentation. The scholarships have to go to Parent Aware. My personal confusion, though, is that there should not be a distinction in quality that the CCAP, sorry, I'm going to stumble, the CCAP families are getting any differently than scholarships. For me personally, I would prefer that CCAP is funded rather than the scholarships. I personally don't like the scholarships, but I haven't gotten to that part yet. I would prefer that CCAP get the funding and have the quality care that we are already doing. It also does come down to, and I think this is a part where I'm very uncomfortable in all these conversations, is there is a point about when we talk and was presented before about family choice. A lot of this stuff is going to start limiting, defining, changing where family choice is and what a family wants and how they're going to do that. And this, all of these layers, that's a huge concern of myself and other family child care providers. Hopefully, back to the question, the quality is documented through the Parent Aware. The scholarships go through that. Right now, CCAP does not have the Parent Aware connection. It may or may not by the end of the session. As far as the terminology babysitters, you know, I would probably say the majority of us do not function under that, I would like to say and hope. Are there people out there? Yes, but CCAP money goes to family members providing care versus licensed in centers. So that money gets diverse many different directions where the scholarships are strictly only going through Parent Aware, which can only be family settings, schools, centers. That, I don't know if that complicated or helped.
I think the whole thing is...
And thank you, Chair Mulley. And to your point, we have, and this is what complicates it, we have CCAP funding, we have early learning, and the Ed Policy Committee's meeting over there, we're going to talk about high standards in teaching. And we've muddied these waters, and I'm afraid we're blurring them back up. And I don't want to be disingenuous to the very hardworking preschool educators and so forth. I just want to make sure we're doing it right. So...
Mr. Chair, if I could just address Representative Crenshaw's point, and I think there's a handout here, I don't know if everybody has it, but if you just break down where kids are, who are 0 to 5, 80,000 kids are in family child care settings, 57,000 are in child care centers, 23,000 are in public school-based pre-kindergarten, and 14,000 are in Head Start or pre-Head Start. What that tells you is we've got a pretty significant diversity of where kids are, and the idea behind the scholarships is to create an incentive for improving quality everywhere that kids are in order to qualify for the more money that we're ready to put, at least I am, and I think others are ready to put into this. You leverage the quality for all the kids who are in all these places by requiring the Parent Aware for those scholarship dollars to come in. I don't know that any of the other changes are even needed, because I think when people, when providers want to have those new scholarship dollars coming in to serve more kids, they have a big incentive to raise their standards. And there's no distinction. When you're a child care provider, a family child care provider, there's no difference between child care and education. And that's the whole idea behind the scholarship, is to deliberately kind of cross those lines. Because if you can't help a child develop and learn where they are today, I don't think we're going to be successful. I think you have to take this money and the quality where the kids are in the settings that parents choose, rather than saying we're going to create sort of one model that everybody has to move towards.
And Representative Creason, one one problem when you're talking about getting quality. For instance, when I talk to social workers in some of the inner city areas, CCAP pays, I believe it's 25% of the going rate. So, and then it can be up to 40%, I think, if it's, or is it 45% if it's four-star rated or something like that. But they say, where is the family going to get the money to get one like that when we're only paying a tiny portion of it? So that's a problem. But did you have another question?
No, my final comment is, and I think we all agree on the intent, but we're trying to put this into legislation. And I mean, if we could, what you articulated, Representative Winkler, if we could make that perfect, that's, I think we're heading in the right direction.
Representative Kreshaw, we will never achieve perfection. But we should keep trying every session to get closer to it.
We aren't approaching very fast. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the most part, Ms. Cunningham did sum up perfectly what I wanted to say. But I also do want to stress that just because a program is not rated or perhaps chooses not to be rated does not mean it is not a quality program, does not mean that there is not a learning going on. Children learn at every stage of the day, whether it be coming into that door and taking off their shoes and hanging up their jacket and doing activities with the child care provider, going on a walk. I mean, their minds are absorbing all steps of the way. I'm just going to stress again, and every time that the Mini Minds and the Coalition is in my office, they've heard how much I dislike these programs. But we won't hash that over again. But parents, of course, are the best determinant of what quality is. And by slapping a government-rated star on that program does not mean that as a parent, I looked up my counties, and there are no home license providers listed. But my children go to a provider, and I would consider her a four-star. I am a parent. I have researched. I used to do child care, as you all know, not for 16 years, like Glenn Grunhagen's school board thing. But I know what I am looking for when I do child care. And if my provider was slapped with a one-star on a government-rated program, in my mind, because I know what she is doing with those children, not just mine, but the other kids in there, to me, she would be a four-star. And I would just love for those that are designing legislation here that are based in the metro to come to Greater Minnesota and take a look at what we have to offer there. Because what a lot of these bills, a lot of this legislation is based on issues that take place here in the metro and in the surrounding areas. But it's a lot different when you get back to Greater Minnesota, and we communities, they know each other, they know, we talk to one another, and parents know exactly where the not so good quality providers are located, and we're not going to send our kids there.
Representative Franzen, there's a big issue that many of us, issue's not only in Greater Minnesota, but it's a huge issue in trying to figure out what we do on this, as with the issue of immigrants, especially most recent immigrants, and how much more do they get quality from being with a relative. The Hmong community that came over from the Watt recently, the Karen who just came over from Burma, there's a lot of issues right here, too, not just in rural Minnesota, but Representative Winkler.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would just add, Representative Franzen, what we're trying to do is create a balance. I'm sure that you, based on your experience, you have a very good idea of what a quality child care setting is. Personally, I don't think I'm necessarily the best judge. I know it feels good, but I think there's a lot of expertise that child care providers and early educators bring that I don't necessarily know about as a parent. So I actually think a rating system, a national accreditation program that a provider goes through is helpful to me as a parent to understand what would be the best quality. And, I think providing more information to parents can't really be a bad thing. And folks in Greater Minnesota may choose a different model, but I don't think their kids need a different set of environments. I think they need roughly the same thing. They need a nurturing, supportive environment with enriched learning opportunities and social and emotional development that's going to help them succeed in life. And
the time is already really, we have to go on.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take a vote on the bill.
We have to get out of here tonight. And it's been a real long week and a long session for everybody, even though it's only 3 weeks. it feels like 3 months. Representative Winkler renews his motion that House File 2754 be re-referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
All carries. Thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you for catching me, Representative Winkler. You didn't catch it either. Your bill was 1880. It was down here on what I'm supposed to say was wrong, and I read that.
I'm certain I would renew my motion.
Mr. Chair,
House File 1880 be re-referred to the Committee on Education.
Thank you. All in favor say aye.
Aye. All
opposed, no.
No.
Sure. Sorry.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good.
Good. Good to see you.
You're with us.
Yes.
That's confusing.
Oh, I got to get my phone.
The chair is long. Hi, she needs to get it. What do I call it? What? An Adam chair. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, well, I just looked on the chair and I was like, because she's worked by others. She is a home provider. She's working on it. And so she's in the building quality.
All right, continuing on here, Representative Mullery will move. Excuse me? That House File 2.
Well, when you go to the website.
Excuse me, we'll get going here. Thank you. Representative Mullery moves at House File 2.
Ms. Jones? Just bang it.
Excuse me. We're going to continue on here. Representative Mullery moves at House File 2558 be re-referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. Go ahead, Representative
Thank
Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill consists of several different parts, and the one that I'm most concerned about is the early learning scholarships, and I think this has something that needs to be done this session. It puts the Office of Early Learning back in charge of it, which is where the legislature put it last year, and there is a reason for that. It's a coordinating agency that's supposed to work with different departments, and for instance, the early learning scholarships in some areas have to be coordinated or should be coordinated with CCAP and things like that, so it makes sense to have the Office of Early Learning, which is under the different departments, actually coordinating these problems or issues. Another one.
Can I just ask you, Representative Mullery, where is it now?
It's in MDE.
Oh, thank you.
And that was done in, I believe, conference committee. Mm-hmm. I think that's where it happened. At the insistence of the executive branch.
Thank you.
Ms., and I can't pronounce her first name, Robinson, brought up the issue of paperwork, and so this would, if you qualify for MFIP or free or reduced lunch, you would automatically qualify, at least meet the qualification level. Maybe not, you might have to go further on defining the amount of it if it's if it gets into that, but you'd at least be qualified without the, I think she said, 9 pages of paperwork. This also makes sure, because there's some doubt whether or not receiving an early scholarship affects the amount of the seed cramp grant, this would provide specifically that it won't affect that. This also, as Representative Winkler and his testifiers and everybody I've talked to has pointed out, the 5,000 cap really doesn't work. When I went to the Neighborhood Achievement Zone, all of you were here with Sandra Samuels testifying, who leads that. That was the first thing said by everybody that works under her, is that that's got to go immediately. They were just couldn't get it to work together for to make this work to get them into quality care. This will look at the going rate in each area and use that in setting the amounts for scholarship in the area. It also provides that a large part of the scholarships go to children ages 0 to 3, because research indicates, an awful lot of national research indicates, that this could be the most important time in the brain development, and to wait until they're older than age 3 just doesn't seem to make sense. We should be getting at so this would have a portion of the amounts going to children before they reach their third birthday. And it also gets into the issue of how do we send out money. For instance, a lot of people think that all of the factors, I don't know if it's that highly rated among the researchers everywhere in the country, but everybody's talking about the ACEs factors, and Robert Anden, I met with him alone for an hour and three quarter, and he stressed extremely hard that poverty by itself is not the factor, it's what else goes around that. And so if you're just in poverty and you don't have any other negative factors and you've got a lot of positive factors, you're probably going to come out a lot better. And so it's more other factors. And so I build in some things that would try to get at some other factors, and then ask the commissioner to look into other factors in setting the amounts. Then with regard to something that I was pushing really hard last year was, and we did put some more money into it, I believe, although I couldn't keep track of what was going on in conference because things were going in and out very fast. But the visiting nurse program, having them teach the interactive brain development techniques to parents is something I'm really concerned about. That's the time when the child's brain is the most active at forming, and it's so critical that parents know how to interact with their child, and the best way to do that is through having either the visiting nurse trained or having somebody go in with them. And then the other thing that this does is it gets at the CCAP. Right now, as I mentioned, we're having CCAP pays 25% of the going rate, basically, and then you get the 15% or 20 for 3 or 4 stars. Mine would pay the going rate, and also it gets rid of the waiting list for CCAP on the basic sliding fee, because people tell me that they can't get decent child care because they make just a little bit over the bare minimum for MPIP, and I mean maximum for MPIP, and so they're ending up not being able to afford quality child care because of that. So those are the basics. And then today we have Megan I got it right. I was used to.
You got it right.
My whole life, I'm Irish. I always heard Megan, and we have a Megan, and Gunner, who's head of the Institute for Child Development here at the University of Minnesota, and Arthur Reynolds, who is, I believe, also in the Institute of Child Development here, and both are extremely internationally known. All of us have heard of the Art Rolnick study. Well, the biggest study on this is the Chicago study, and Professor Reynolds is the one that conducted that. And it's interesting when I go to these conferences around the country on early brain development. A lot of people here always look to the other side of the mountain being greener or something. We have one of the very best research institutions on this issue, both early childhood and youth development here at the University of Minnesota. So with that, I'd like to let them testify on this.
Let's move your amendment first.
Oh, I'm sorry. I would move the amendment,
the A1 amendment
to get it in the shape the author wants, and it's actually the shape I talked about when I went through it.
Okay. So then all those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Amendment is adopted.
Thank
and
you.
To go forth. Who's first?
I think I am.
Thank you.
Professor Gunner.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity.
Introduce yourself.
Do I have to again? All right, good. I've got it here. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to discuss what we know about early brain development, effective early interventions, and who benefits most. As Chairman Mullery said, I am a professor at the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota. My name is Megan Gunner. My husband's from Texas. He says Megan when he says Megan, so I answer to either. I am here today with my colleague Arthur Reynolds, who is a faculty member also at the Institute of Child Development and also in the Humphrey Institute, and along with his colleagues Art Rolnick, Judy Temple, and Rob Grunewald, who is sitting back there. He directs the Human Capital Research Collaborative, which is a center dedicated to evaluating interventions to understand what works to improve the functioning of high-risk children and their families. And as Chairman Mullery mentioned, he was also the one who developed the child parent centers out of Chicago, and he is now the principal investigator of a $15 million grant investing in innovations from the U.S. Department of Education, and they're conducting an expansion of these programs to see if they can get them to work on a large scale. As I'm sure you're aware, because I have spoken to many of you over the years, our brains are not fully developed at birth. Much of the postnatal development of the brain architecture occurs in those first 5 years of life. And, of course, it's not all over by age five, but it is true that the first 5 years, and even more critically, the first 3 years, lay the foundation for all future development. The skills and capacities that are developed in these early years influence the skills that can be built upon them. Skills beget skills. And like a building a house, the foundation matters. And it's very difficult and very expensive to go back and fix the foundational, the basement, once you're already working on the first or the second floors. Experience is critical to brain development because the brain wires itself through processing information. In fact, in a large measure, the brain becomes what the brain does, what it thinks about. Young brains learn through serve and return interactions with the objects and people around them. For example, the baby smiles and the adult smiles and talks back. That's one's the serve, the other's the return, and the brain confirms the wiring that supported that interaction. Being an active member of a stimulation-rich serve and return environment supports the development of healthy brain architecture and a brain that is prepared to be a powerful learning machine. Recent research from our colleagues in Wisconsin, in fact, has shown that although brains start out with the same volume, gray matter volume, at 5 months of age, by 3 years of age, brains that have been developing in poor serve and return environments are significantly smaller than brains who have been allowed to develop in stimulation-rich kinds of environment. Now, it shouldn't be scary. It's not all over by age three, even though your gray matter volume is very different. Stimulation will allow you to grow that gray matter volume after that, but you are starting from behind. It's the same pattern that we have also seen in language development. By age two or three, we see the achievement gap already present in the language that children have. And the more language you have, the more things you understand. So you have an engine that's driving you forward. You can catch up, but it takes extra effort. So this is why most of us who study this area say part of the reason that the achievement gap is so stubborn is that we're starting too late if we wait till school. Going back and starting at age three with these scholarships, fabulous. And now once you get that right and get it really fully funded, we're going to come back and say, but you got to go back earlier as well. We know that one method that's been effective in going back earlier, and we have it well set up in Minnesota, is the Minnesota Nurse-Family Partnerships and the Family Home Visitors. We heard the lady earlier talking about how important that had been to her. And we know that those kinds of things work when you have highly trained practitioners and a validated and culturally sensitive curriculum. But we have to do more. And the policies that you're looking at today, of course, are part of what should be in our arsenal. For over 40 years, researchers have both argued over the impact of childcare and begun to see childcare as a potentially useful vehicle for closing the achievement gap before it gets too large. In addition to the kind of really focused interventions you've all heard about, the Cadillac interventions of Perry Preschool and Abbasindarian, we also know that high-quality early childcare can be effective in supporting the intellectual and socio-emotional development of children. Some of this work comes in from a national study called the National Child Care Study, which some of you may have heard of. They started this study when kids were 6 months of age. The kids are now in their late 20s and early 30s, so they've been following these individuals for a long time. In a number of analyses, they've shown that the more time between 6 months and 5 years, and it's only 6 months because that's where they started, it could have been birth in 5 years, that a child has spent in high quality settings until they get to kindergarten, the better the child's academic performance in math and language arts up past third grade. And that's child care, right? To speak to an earlier issue, high quality child care is early education, developmentally appropriate early education. These findings hold even though they control for family income and education, but more importantly, if you go in and say who benefited the most, it's the children from high-risk backgrounds, defined not only by income and education of the parents, but also characteristics like marital instability and so on. In fact, the whole debate about childcare, which started out with us being concerned we were harming kids, has turned into figuring out who are we helping the most by high-quality programs. Poverty is a factor that captures a lot of the likelihood for kids that really need help, but it is not a cause. Alone, it's not likely to be what's causing the problem with brain development. It's just if we look at poverty, we pick up a lot of the kids. The causes are those things that undermine the capacity of the adult surrounding the child to be good at enriching and being enriching and supportive partners in the child's development, like lack of time and energy due to working long hours, chronic worry and anxiety over how to keep the family's head above water, a history of maltreatment and abuse that makes it hard for the parents to deal with the 24/7 needs of one or more small children, concentrated poverty and crime that damage the social fabric and isolates families from one another, bouts of enforced separation from mother or dad due to the fact they're in jail, high residential mobility because of lack of affordable housing, and so on. These are the things that, as you add them up, create our best predictors of who needs that high, who will benefit the most from that high quality early care. And these risks, if we can get them into stable and promote their development. However, as my colleague will tell you now, the most effective programs include parents and help parents learn to be the child's first and best teacher and help parents feel comfortable being in the academic world with the child because it's a place they feel like they belong. So I turn this now over to my colleague, Arthur Reynolds.
You can't
turn it. I can't. Madam Chairman, would you please turn this over?
When you're head of a department.
I'm so used to being in charge. I know.
Thank you for your testimony. I very much appreciated it. And Dr. Reynolds?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Arthur Reynolds. I'm a professor of child development and public affairs at the University of Minnesota. And members of the committee, thank you for inviting me today to discuss early education. In the Human Capital Research Collaborative Institute of Child Development in Humphrey School, we study the impact and cost effectiveness of programs and practices from prenatal development to young adulthood, and the identification and dissemination of programs most likely to provide high cost savings are critical for addressing the socioeconomically based performance gaps spanning school readiness to educational attainment. Now, based on the most recent Minnesota school readiness study, large gaps in school readiness are evident. Although 73% of all kindergartners assessed in the fall of 2012 were found to be school ready, the gaps by family income and parental educational attainment were as high as 20 points. If we accounted for families at 185% of the federal poverty line or the 100% poverty line that's used for Head Start, the gap would be 25 points or more at school entrance. And as the committee fully recognizes, this must be urgently addressed. The accumulated knowledge in early education and child development points to a set of research-based elements I would like to describe as a guide for increasing access and improving quality in early education in Minnesota and thereby reducing the school readiness gap. These are called the 10 essential elements of effective early care and education programs. They provide a framework for enhancing effectiveness that is consistent with the guiding principles of the Minnesota Early Learning Council that I quote, whose goal is to rely on evidence, to rely on research and evaluation of health and education outcomes in developing recommendations. Now, the 10 elements were developed by Susan Newman and me and presented at the 2006 Minnesota Governor's Summit on School Readiness. They became adopted as evidence-based principles of programming in the Early Learning Council of the State of Minnesota in 2010. Programs that focus on the following 10 elements are most likely to promote sustained effects. The first one is to prioritize children at risk in enrollment and participation. The second one is to begin early, as early as possible. The third is to optimize the length and duration of services. The fourth is to implement intensive instructional strategies. The fifth essential element is to provide small class sizes and child to staff ratios. The sixth is to provide comprehensive family services, especially parent involvement and engagement in children's education and community. The seventh is to provide compensatory services to enhance skills. The eighth is to include highly trained professionals and ongoing professional development. The ninth is to coordinate and align effective transitions to kindergarten in the early grades. And last but not least is to establish a strong accountability system. I'd like to briefly highlight a few of these elements. In support of prioritizing or targeting children at risk, which is element one, a convergence of findings from research over five decades from pilot projects to large-scale established public programs at multiple levels show that the benefits of preschool programs on school readiness and later outcomes are greatest for the children most at risk. In these studies, children at risk are typically defined in one of three ways. One is by low family income, either based on the federal poverty line or up to the free and reduced price lunch guideline of 185% of poverty. The second would be neighborhood disadvantage or concentrated poverty, or eligibility for Title I school services. The third one would be exposure to multiple risk factors or a pileup of risk factors and adverse life events such as child abuse and neglect, homelessness and frequent mobility that Professor Gunnard just spoke about. One of the most extensive longitudinal studies of children at risk is that of the Title I-funded child-parent centers, and is especially significant since it is a large-scale public program originating in Chicago, but is now being scaled up in the St. Paul Public Schools under an investing and innovation project from the U.S. Department of Education that I direct at the university with many partners. Some children in the program receive early childhood scholarships from the state's Early Childhood Challenge Grant. The scale-up is occurring because CPC produces large and enduring impacts that follow the 10 essential elements. Reports in the study over 30 years for over 1,500 children from high-poverty neighborhoods show that preschool graduates begin kindergarten at the national average in readiness skills far ahead of low-income children who did not attend the program. Children's achievement gains from the program were sustained all the way through school, and later rates of special education and child maltreatment were cut in half. Most important, participants had greater readiness for college and careers, including higher rates of high school graduation, better job skills, and lower rates of crime in adulthood. And the initial findings of the CPC scale-up show strong preschool gains already. Now, CPC's return on investment is high, with about $7 to $11 of benefits returned for every dollar of program cost. And the CPC return on investment was cited in President Obama's 2013 State of the Union Address as a rationale for expanding preschool access and quality. Now, the program and other similar evidence-based interventions with a high return on investment provide comprehensive family services, from parenting education to social supports. These programs are also intensive in their instructional focus on language, numeracy, and social-emotional development, and also provide multiple years of services, typically beginning at least by age 3. The synergy of the 10 elements is an effective recipe for closing the achievement gap. And, of course, establishing the most effective early childhood system from birth to 5 provides a strong foundation for sustaining these gains with strong kindergarten and elementary grade services, which is element 9. Now, today you are considering scholarship programs and other programs to help get high-risk children into high-quality early education settings. And as the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation pilot scholarship program showed, that these scholarships serve as a helpful tool to enhance school readiness for high-risk children. It is one important strategy to help close the achievement gap. However, as I indicated earlier, that programs like this are most effective if they're targeted to the children that are most at risk, and this risk, does extend beyond poverty to the early home and community context of learning that I also discussed. And Madam Chairman, we'd be happy now to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, any questions from the committee members? You wowed us.
Madam Chair, this is, and I know Representative Meyer was at the NCSL, and she went through their program, and I was actually lucky because she was in the initial class, and they added a lot of stuff the second year, and this is the same thing I'm hearing at conferences all across the country with Japan people, no matter where they're from.
Right, my concern is that as we look at money and policy, we align with what the research says rather than just
what the
do political programs.
Just what the legislature usually ignores with everything.
So thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify?
I'm a little bit concerning. Is this, or is this still?
You can come on down. Yes, come on.
I had signed to be, signed up to testify regarding this bill also. And I'm very humbled to sit at the table with both of you. I've been following the University of Minnesota studies on early childhood education since mid-1990s. Well, not as well-versed as I would love to be.
Introduce yourself.
I'm more. Sorry. It's Cindy Cunningham, family child care provider. I apologize. My voice is going. there's a lot in all of these bills. My largest concern over the scholarships, the funding is very difficult to apply to family child care providers because there, again, is no allocation for the differential between our business costs. We don't run the same as centers. If that funding and those targets don't meet and are not allocated in a manner that meets my program rates, that will limit and how often those children can be in my care. So if the rate surveys are used for that and those target rates are doing that, my question is it just going to be what I charge, or is it going to go to those targets and those percentages? And I'm not a financial person, but I really do not see that spelled out well in the bills of how those finances are going to be done. Our concern, we've had many discussions between providers, is that if we get $5,000 or $7,000 or whatever it is, if it isn't what our program rates are, and those parents aren't required or we're not able to charge the difference, how are we going to be able to continue care with those children? And it doesn't matter what rate you put that at, unless you just do an open book, whatever my standing rate is, I can't charge more for a scholarship than I would for my general population, and pay whatever my personal going rate is. If you use the, if you use the survey rates and try to use that, such as the CCAP programs have used, there will be a huge problem to try to implement that into family child care and give continuity for care. The other piece is, and I so appreciate hearing the piece about the inclusion of the family. That is my hugest concern in these scholarships. We're looking at taking 0 to 3, 3 to 5, whatever it is, and put these children in quality care. It's commendable, but it is lost if we don't do anything about what the family's condition is. If we don't do anything about their work, their socioeconomics, we are somehow creating a process that says, I, as a child care provider, can somehow get these children ready for kindergarten, ready to be successful, and go on. I've heard many teachers in the school system be upset about that kind of burden on it. We, as child care providers, whatever our family is, and again, I have had families with utilizing CCAP, if there's a challenge with the child, anybody who works with anybody else's children knows the ultimate driving force on what's happening with that child, no matter how many hours. I have them 10 hours a day, 5 days a week. My own children have been in full-time care and part-time care prior to this. The ultimate indicator about whether or not they're going to be successful in my care or onward is the family. It is totally missing in the early childhood scholarships. I wish I could have testified last year, but I was a little busy with a few other things in legislation. So, however this goes through, I really, I would say as family child care providers who I speak to, that is the biggest miss in this. It's basically saying to families and to the population that I somehow am going to magically create these children into something, and I don't know if you're aware of where that is in the program. Another big piece, and I'm kind of not sure where to fit some of these things into these bills because of all three of them here at the same time, but there is also another concern in this as far as the rating system in family child care, is that if 3 and 4 star, the put out for parent aware and how it's getting implemented across the state is spotty at best. Family child care providers as a whole, I'm enrolled and I'm starting, are very confused, put off, don't see the reasoning for it because of where our populations are. I personally have said, no matter what we want to think about it, the funding's coming through and the likelihood of my business having someone using an early childhood scholarship is increasing. That probability theory is increasing. So it behooves me to not enter into a program that is available for quality to document my quality. Family providers are very, again, not buying into it in general, at least many of them that I'm talking to. And back to the center push and the school push, that will limit, and whether it's by design, I live with Venn diagrams in my life, and the overlapping factor is that the majority of the money in the program and the terminology that flies around is center-based and school-based. In filling out the application, I
scribbled up the application, and I said, I think you gave me the wrong application because this is a center application. And no, it says family child care across the top, and I said, nothing in this terminology refers to me as a family child care provider. So whoever is implementing, however this is going, family child care is not embraced in this process, is not really looked about the impacts of how things are going. Again, the funding for the business model, and my hugest piece is there's conferences built into Parent Aware. There is not a component that improves these children's lives when we send them home. CCAP does that. And you know, the families I've had, they have had the improvement when I've watched my parents going off to job, going off to school, and I listen to those parents talk to those children about how that will improve their lives and watch that how, and both of my families have been able to be gainfully employed and move off of CCAP. That dynamic in those children's life has been huge, and I don't hear those kinds of things discussed, but I really am concerned about somehow this appears to be a magical take these children out of low poverty, bad situations, the list that you mentioned, and somehow put them in me, and I'm going to have my magic fairy wand out that day. It won't happen. We will sit here 5-10 years from now, and we will still have the same challenges with children unless those two aspects are looked at. So,
thank you. I think that partly you were in support of this bill without knowing it.
Well, it's in agreement that there's a part.
All right. Representative Myra.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Ms. Cunningham, thank you for your comments. I truly appreciate them. Your emphasis on the importance of parents and the family is crucial. As Chair Mullery stated, I am a NCSL Early Learning Fellow, and it was a privilege to attend the conference. And while there, I learned that the results from the 2010 impact study on Head Start show that there was no lasting value. And I found that very disconcerting. And after I was a fellow, I found out that the 2012 impact study, and if for those of you who don't know, that is a study that was commissioned by U.S. Congress, and it was commissioned back in 1998. And so it was over a whole decade that work was done, and showed that early learning program of Head Start had no value, significant value after the third grade. However, there are a number of studies that Art Rolnick has discussed, the Abecedarian, the Perry Preschool, and the Child Parent Centers. And in looking deeper into those studies, one of the things that really has struck me as someone who really cares about the development of children and their improved education is the very important aspect that parents play. I mean, it's huge in those particular programs. And the programs that we are trying to, or that are being discussed here, do not actually follow those models. Though Abecedarian starts at zero and has home visiting, and the Perry Preschool had classroom, but also very heavy involvement of parents. And so I am, in looking at this whole area, very concerned about the importance of engaging and empowering parents. That is just really crucial to me. Thank you for your comments. I appreciate your coming tonight.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mullery.
I'm in total agreement, and the Representative Moran's promise to all of them, the one that's in North Minneapolis and North Neighborhood Achievements, is all of it, which you heard of. They take that approach to it, and if you've read the bill for next week, 29-21, that would set up, I think, 8 of those around the state. Mm-hmm. So where you really take an overall approach, you break down all of these different silos, and go really at it, which is what you're talking about.
And Representative Mullery, doesn't some of your bill actually cover some of those things, like bringing it down to the early years?
It does go down to 0-3, because right now to exclude those doesn't seem to make any sense to me when the study, in fact, what I just, a few weeks ago, I saw one study which they probably know all the, I just saw a brief, but what it was it took children, very, very poor children in inner cities from 0 to 3, and one group had a lot of work with the interplay between taught the parent the interplay and how to develop the brain that way. The other, there was nothing going on that way with teaching parents anything. And then the third group was wealthy kids, very wealthy. And from the kids who were really poor at age 3 had the same brain development on everything as the really wealthy kids, and without any continuance of help. At 5 they were like that, and at 7 they were like that. And the ones that didn't have anything just basically stayed down the whole period. So that's why it's so important to start early, and that's why part of mine goes to that early period. So important.
Right. And you just spoke
and
to...
And also that what Representative Meyer brought up about the visiting nurse program actually expanding and teaching how to teach, actually coaching the parents and watching them and saying how what you do right and what you do wrong, things like that and so forth.
Right, so your bill includes the early years, the home visiting, the family involvement that were spoken of. So, yes.
Could I say something?
And just state your name again.
Yes, my name is Megan Gunner from the University of Minnesota. I think, and probably Arthur could help me here, from what we understand, when you have really high-risk parents, teaching the parent, working with the parent to help them understand how to work with the child is important, but those families often also then need a high-quality setting for the child to be in part of the day. That's the combination. As in anything, when you're really dealing with high-risk, there's no easy. I mean, we need to do multiple things. So a high-quality setting and ramping it up with things that you're doing with the family surrounding that, which is really what Arthur's program is, will give us probably the biggest bang for the buck. So I would hope you don't throw out your scholarship idea here, but rather use it as a foundation to add to it.
Madam Chair,
say your name again.
Arthur Reynolds, it's a follow-up, just to amplify point. I think we've done a lot of work looking at sort of how we can understand, like, what's causing the long-term effect that we see in terms of the higher rates of graduation, adulthood development, health and well-being. And what we find in our work with the CPC program is that a very large percentage of the effects that we see in adulthood in terms of, better well-being, at least, about a third of that effect we can trace to the strengthening of the parent involvement and engagement that the program was facilitating early on in childhood. So a very large percentage of the later effect in adulthood is through this pathway of the parent involvement pathway. And I think that's, it's very significant. And the reason that you see it in the CPC program, and it tends to be a lot more intensive than, say, in Head Start, is that you have sort of a menu-based system of parent involvement. There's a lot of ways for parents to get involved, and the menu system allows, whether it's going back to get a GED, following in the classroom, going on field trips, there's a very wealth of activities and engagement that's occurring, and that there's services and staff that are there to help as well. And so that's a huge part of the program. And if a child is in, say, the St. Paul Promise Zone in the St. Paul Public Schools, that if they get their scholarship there in the CPC program, they will get all those services. And there are some, there's up to about 30 in the CPC program in St. Paul is in the Promise Zone, and those children would be getting, scholarship dollars in the CPC expansion project in St. Paul.
All right, thank you. I think we're probably ready to vote. I would just like to say that I wish that Representative Winkler and Representative Mullery would combine their bills somehow to make them both fiscally and policy-wise acceptable to what we've just learned from the research. All right. Representative Mallory renews his motion that House File 2558, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay.
Nay.
No.
Motion is adopted.
Thank you very much.
Okay, welcome, Representative Myra. Representative Myra will move that House File 2381 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. So, go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you. I so much appreciate having House File 2381 heard. House File 2381 seeks to engage and empower parents. It works within current appropriations. I would like to highlight the main changes brought forward in this bill. First, on lines 1.7 and 1.8, the administration of the early childhood scholarships are placed within the Office of Early Learning. The interagency spanning the Department of Education, Health, and Human Services. Early childhood education providers are regulated by MDE and DHS. Second, lines 2.13 and 2.14 makes the scholarships not subject to withholdings for dues and fees. Third, lines 2.21 through 2.26 repeals the 5,000 arbitrary cap on scholarships and requires the director to establish average scholarship amounts based on current available market surveys. Fourth, lines 2.23 and 2.24 requires average scholarship amounts be proportionate across regions and counties. Fifth, lines 2.26 through 2.30 provides for financial incentives to pursue higher ratings. Sixth, subdivision 4 allows for the director to declare programs eligible to participate based on certain factors. Limiting eligibility programs to only 3- and 4-star rated programs limits access in our underserved parts of the state. Madam Chair, I have two witnesses, Mr. Bartholomew and Ms. Wallstein.
Introduce yourself and then go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. We've been strong supporters of the Parent Aware Rating System and the related early ed scholarships. And he's left, but while we wanted to thank Representative Winkler for Section 1 of his bill, we asked that you support House File 2381. We believe Representative Myra's bill will strengthen Parent Aware and the scholarships. And there are two points that I'd like to emphasize. The first is creating the flexible scholarship amounts that will more closely reflect family needs. Again, as Representative Myra mentioned, those are between lines 2.21 and 2.30. And we also like the idea of providing the 15 and 20% bump for 3- and 4-star programs, as she mentioned, as an incentive to reach higher levels of quality. The second is extending the eligibility for providers who are in the Parent Aware system but haven't reached 3- or 4-star status by 2016. We think this will help foster the growth of providers that will participate in Parent Aware, and largely by helping meet where they are, and as long as they've committed to be within the system, we think that's a plus, and we think they ought to be recognized for that. So again, briefly at 8:09, we'd ask for your support of House File 2381. Thank you.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, Amy Wallstein, the Director of Education and Workforce Development for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber supports policies to improve kindergarten readiness by streamlining and aligning early childhood resources, strengthening the parent-aware rating system, and providing expanded access to quality early childhood education. We believe strongly that the scholarship cap needs to be removed. Representative Winkler presented language that would do that, and that's also included in Representative Myra's bill. So what I'd like to encourage the committee to consider is the language in Subdivision 3, I think that's the 2.21 to 2.30, that would provide greater proportionality throughout Minnesota, as well as increases based on provider rating. I'd also encourage the committee to consider the language in Subdivision 4 that gives providers just a little bit more time to meet the rating requirements. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? And any other testifiers, anybody else in the audience that would like to speak to this? Thank you. Is Cindy going to come forward?
I intended to, and I'm starting to feel like a broken record. my concerns are in this section is, again, the 3- and 4-star rating as being the target for 216. For receiving scholarships, I think limits greatly, in particular with family child care, the development and encouragement through participating in Parent Aware. Many newer providers, many established providers to go through the whole 4-star rating. I understand that's built in here, but still the expectation is for 3- and 4-star rating. I would suggest that as providers, to be in the system of Parent Aware and to be working towards and on those things would establish enough. So a 1- and 2-star rating, I don't understand why that's not a quality enough care to engage and improve children's lives. Again, I will continue to say about this average rating, the great concern I have is that in legislation it is stated that with a CCAP family I can charge the difference between what my program rate is and what they are allocated as a CCAP family. I have not seen anything in any of the legislation addressing that under the scholarship programs. So I have been approached by one family to potentially be in Parent Aware, and there's no answer out there. I'm not fully engaged in it yet, so maybe I'll learn that. But no, I've asked many times, and I have yet to find the answer. If that scholarship doesn't cover, once that scholarship money runs out, who pays or do I terminate? I cannot continue with care at that point. So I've not seen the answer.
Okay, any questions, comments from the committee? Would you like to make some more comments?
No. No, Madam Chair, I just would renew my motion that House File 2381 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance.
All right, thank you. Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
And the motion is adopted. Thank you. And with that, we stand adjourned.